In the completely appropriate request that we try to stop in time for people who have classes immediately after this to actually not be chronically late to their class, and I think that's more than reasonable. And since, in fact, I always have more to say than we have time to say, disciplining me isn't a bad thing in this context either. So I will stop at, I'll shoot for 10 till 12, which is actually when we're supposed to stop, right? Isn't it supposed to go till 11:50?
We'll start at 9:55.
What?
We'll start at 9:55.
Oh yeah, we could start 5 minutes before. Yeah, well, I'll stop at 10 till, and that's the appropriate time to stop. All right. Okay, so here's where we're at. We've laid out the logic of historical materialism as a general theory of history. It's governed by functional explanations and two rhythms of historical development. One centered around the more or less continuous, although the pace will vary, development of the forces of production. Sometimes it develops very slowly, sometimes rapidly. So there's but it has a cumulative character. And the episodic transformation of the relations of production, which once they are established, remain fixed because they are supported by a structure, the superstructure, another functional explanation. And episodically, the relations of production are transformed. The continuous, more or less smooth development of the force of production, the episodic smashing and transformation of relations of production, the great epochs of history are defined by are named by the relations of production. So we have pre-class society, we have coercively extractive class societies, we have capitalism as the three great epochs of history from the point of view of historical materialism, and a projected fourth epoch, post-capitalist society, or class, tending towards classless society as a projected fourth one. The transitions between those epochs are relatively rapid compared to the length of the epochs themselves. They don't have to have the explosive transformation of a momentary revolution, but it's more or less an abrupt era of turbulence and transformation, which then allows the continuous development of the force of production to continue to go on. Okay, that's the architecture of the Cohen argument. Again, animated by this very interesting and complex kind of explanation called functional explanation. There are a bunch of criticisms of this theory. Some of them there are reasonable responses to, and others I think are more problematic. I've listed them in the outline. These are addressed in the paper which I wrote with Andrew Levine, which is in the readings. So I don't think it's necessary for me to, in detail, go through every one of them, but I'll say at least something about each. Okay, so the first criticism centers on the development thesis. It's been argued in some of the critical essays on Cohen, particularly a paper written by Josh Cohen, a philosopher at Stanford, Joshua Cohen. Criticism that the forces of production really don't have a systematic tendency to develop over time. That the idea that they have a tendency to develop over time is just too strong. That human beings are perfectly happy for the force of production to remain absolutely stagnant. And that after all, Homo sapiens, in their modern biological form, as far as we know, emerged somewhere around 100,000 years or so ago, perhaps even longer. And settled agriculture didn't occur until 10,000 years or so ago. Well, there you got 90,000 years more or less with them remaining hunting and gathering societies. And while it may be true that by the end of that period, the stone implements they were using were more advanced than they were at the beginning. Undoubtedly, that's true. I mean, I don't know the details, but there certainly was technical change. That's an awfully slow development of the forces of production to have such a grandiose theory thesis. The forces of production tend to develop over time. The response to that, I think, is the sticky downwards argument. But as I think the way to think about it is really, you know, Cohen might be, in his language, make it a too strong a kind of motivational argument. You know, he kind of gives the impression, because of the scarcity that we face and our intelligence and our rationality, that we're constantly on the lookout for improvement. As opposed to most people, most of the time, in most societies, whether 50,000 years ago or today, are creatures of habit, that we learn to do things, we have know-how, and mostly we just do them because that's the way we've learned to do them. So that most, in spite of our intelligence and rationality and our obvious creative capacities, which are undeniable, mostly we don't improve the forces of production. Capitalism is distinctive because it creates a set of situations in which there is tremendous pressure on innovation. There's both incentives, but also pressure. It's not just that there's a big payoff, it's that there's big risks if you don't. So capitalism is quite unique. It then creates a culture around that problem, which includes the way you're taught in education to think critically, to come up with new solutions, to treat problem solving as a chance for novelty. So it's a characteristic of, some people think of this as a characteristic of modernity rather than capitalism. That's another theoretical coordinate in which you can talk about these things, where creativity becomes a kind of central cultural value. So that we celebrate creativity and novelty. Sometimes novelty for its own sake, right? The fashion industry makes a lot of money off of the continual sense of being old-fashioned and therefore having to get the newest thing. Okay, so one criticism is that Cohen just way overblows it. Not for capitalism, but as a general transhistorical thing. I think there's perhaps some truth in the criticism of Cohen in the sense that his rhetoric at times might have suggested a stronger impulse for innovation even in earlier societies than really existed. But I think the point still holds. And the sticky downward version is the way to think about it. So that it may be quite rare, except in capitalism, that innovations occur, that improvements in the forces of production occur. Because it may be a relatively rare circumstance that a person with the right kind of observational capacity intersects the context in which the discovery or the new way of doing things can be achieved. The example of why it took tens of thousands of years for metallurgy to be discovered, I think, is probably for just that reason, that you needed fire pits. You needed first to discover how to make fire. So the discovery of how to make fire occurred tens of thousands of years before the Bronze Age. You needed to know how to make fire. Then you had to be making fires in those parts of the surface of the planet where there was ore right on the surface in the rocks that you would use for a fire pit. You know, that's almost certainly the way in which metallurgy was discovered by accident. And then you needed to happen to have the right person to observe it, who was the sort of person with the kind of mind and intelligence to connect the dots and figure out what to do. But what, again, so the point is, the development of the force of production has this impact on history so long as it has a cumulative character. And there's enough random events to eventually produce these transitions to the new levels of productivity that then open up new kinds of surplus production, which then opens up the possibility of new sorts of social relations. So I think the development thesis can basically be kept. I personally think it's a pretty persuasive element of the theory that the forces of production have a tendency to develop in history. We just have to soften the rhetoric, not read back the capitalist impulse for innovation to earlier periods. Fettering. There is no general reason why class relations inevitably fetter the development of the force of production. There's no general reason to believe that that's true. This is the criticism. A good argument may be possible for why a particular kind of class relations has this property under particular circumstances, but there's no general argument for why all forms of class relations, simply by virtue of being exploitative, thus being class relations, would ultimately fetter the development of the forces of production. And indeed, that's precisely why Cohen had to shift the argument for capitalism from development fettering to use fettering. It's just not obvious why capitalism would ever fetter the development of the forces of production. That is why new productivity-enhancing technologies would ever stop being developed in capitalism. I don't see any particular reason why that should be the case. What would be the case in capitalism is this problem of the rational use of productivity. But that's a very different kind of argument. And it also then ceases to be as general an argument. That is, the irrational use of means of production is a very specific argument to a specific stage of capitalism, as opposed to a constituent element of a general theory of history. The shift, however, from development fettering to use fettering is the way out of that problem. The way out of the problem that there's no reason to believe that class relations invariably will better the development of force production. Cohen's solution, which I think is an okay solution for his theoretical purposes, is to shift from development fettering to use fettering. Is this point clear? I see some what I think might be puzzled faces. Is it clear what's in play in this development versus use fettering?
Yeah. Well, it's not quite that same question. So is his argument that it's the class relations that lead to the fettering of forces of production? How then did that first transformation happen when there were no class relations in the very first epoch, and then they developed in the pre-capitalist?
So in the first epoch, it was the economic structure which fettered the further development of the forces of production. It was the social relations. There were social relations of production. Right. So the social relations of production in the pre-class society blocked the further development of the forces of production relative to what a set of class relations would do. So I think there is ambiguity in the first transition. It's not really so clear that it really blocked the development so much as compared to an alternative, it interfered with the development. Yeah.
It seems like you're stating the problem with development fettering differently now than you did in the book, because at least as I read it, it seemed like the problem with development fettering there was that it's an unknown. You wouldn't know that the forces weren't being developed correctly, because it wouldn't be developed correctly. That what would be more apparent was that there wasn't a rational use. And so it seemed like that was the problem. Maybe I'm misunderstanding.
Well, so fettering, okay, so fettering can either mean slow down relative to an alternative, or it can mean stagnation relative to an alternative, right? Mm-hmm. So slowing down relative to an alternative is always hard to argue, because you have to be able to make a credible argument about the speed of development under the alternative. if you have absolute stagnation of the force of production under existing ones, it's easier to make an argument that if you change the relations, you'd unfetter them. I think for all of these, let me just step back from this immediate question. I think for all of these arguments, it's very hard to make the, it'd be very hard for an actor inside of an existing society to make the argument that there's an alternative which will be better from the point of view of unfettering the force of production, either of their development or their use. To say that under alternative relations these related forces will be used better is a hard argument to make in any society. And therefore, it's not plausible that that's actually the way the process works. That the struggle against the relations of production to transform them occurs because there already is in place an alternative which shows and convinces people that it will be better. The struggle against feudalism occurs because there already is in place a set of liberal proto-capitalist relations in which people have more autonomy and capacity to do things, and which shows its dynamism, but in which its dynamism is because it's a niche of alternative relations constrained by the fact that it's occurring within a broadly feudal society. That makes the problem in feudalism more like the problem of pre-class society, because it's really what happens is you get these experiments with early class relations which suddenly unbottle things. And that's what is the demonstration effect that shows this is a good way of doing it, and which then either gets copied or gets imposed on people because it works better. And that's why I think, as you'll see on our weekend retreat at the end of the semester when we discuss alternatives to capitalism, why I think the idea of interstitial transformation in capitalism is so crucial. It's really by building alternative ways of producing and organizing economies, even if that has to be necessarily on a restricted local scale initially. It's really through that that you show that there's a more rational use of the means of production, or possibly a more rapid development of the most humanly relevant technologies under alternative relations. You know, that's what gives it credibility, and then also makes the transformations seem realistic, because the more you have these alternatives in place in partial and incomplete ways, the more likely it is that larger scale transformations become politically tractable. That's the reason why I think it's important, for example, to develop co-ops, worker co-ops, I'm not talking about consumer co-ops, and why figuring out how you unbottle co-ops to make them a more important component of a capitalist economy is an important aspect of getting beyond capitalism. Even though they function within a capitalist economy, it's still an aspect of the process of transforming capitalism. Yeah?
So, just paraphrasing the use federation, make sure that I understand it, you're just saying that use federation is that capitalism will no longer rationally use resources or be able to do so, and therefore will have to be supplanted. That's what use federation is.
That's what use federation is, yeah.
But is it really true that under feudalism people saw capitalism as an alternative and really decided to adopt it because of its, I mean, it seems like in a lot of cases the peasantry was against capitalism, and a lot of the masses wanted something even more radical than
So
they want something like more like socialism, and that the capitalists had to almost put the brakes on.
Right. So you're absolutely right that it's more, the actual transitions are much more complicated, and the coalitions of actors with different agendas, you know, different prospects, and different visions. So what happens in feudalism is that over a long period of time, the integrity of the feudal relations is compromised. Feudal lords begin to act much more like capitalist exploiters. They convert the obligations of their peasants into rents. And the distinction between a capitalist rent and a feudal rent becomes much weaker than it might have otherwise been. The towns begin to be places where feudal peasants can flee to and engage in all sorts of other kinds of activities. Artisanal production begins to develop into proto-capitalist production. And feudal lords begin investing in some of these proto-capitalist activities. So all sorts of things are happening that are kind of loosening up the feudal structure as well. At the time then when the some contingent historical crisis occurs, which makes the state vulnerable, and therefore makes it possible to have a more rapid transformation of the property rights and the legal relations, peasants are struggling to become independent proprietors, you know, to become self-employed small farmers. Urban proto-capitalist interests are struggling to get rid of the tax burden that's extracted against them and to create a liberal bourgeois state that would protect capitalist property rights and, you know, create new ways of dealing with things. So things are very much in flux in those situations, in which then alliances get formed, class alliances. And it just turns out over the messy process of several decades that that class alliance ends up being led by bourgeois forces to create a capitalist order rather than peasant and artisanal forces to create a, you know, petty bourgeois republic of smallholders. You know, so that out of that class alliance and those configurations of forces, that's the one that's successful. Now one might ask, could an alternative have been successful? Probably. And you know, the historical materialist would say probably not, that it was not a viable form, and it would have morphed into capitalism pretty quickly anyway. You know, if somehow or other a petty bourgeois republic of small shopkeepers, artisanal producers, and peasant smallholding farmers had become the dominant coalition and had created a state to support those forms of property relations, if that had gotten in place, within some number of decades it would have become capitalist agriculture, artisanal factories turning into capitalist factories. It wouldn't have developed that way anyway. It just would have had a different historical
series. But it sounds like it's not that people consciously decided that capitalism was going to be the way that, that the forces of production were going to be more developed. It was
they
just
want,
a result of...
Well, they wanted free labor markets as opposed to tied labor. And they wanted a rule of law of property rights in land as opposed to feudal obligations. Those are two key aspects of what renders a system capitalist. So they didn't call it capitalism, they didn't have a system level understanding of it, but they wanted transformations of property rights in ways that rendered them building blocks of capitalism.
But did they want those things because they thought they were going to further the force of production? Or did they just want those things because they served their own economic interests?
Undoubtedly the latter, but it succeeded because it accomplished the former. That is, the reason why those relations became stabilized and became then the dominant form which was able to spread was because of what it unleashed. And the signals that it was that was characteristic was that it generated wealth even under feudalism. You know, that it was generating a lot of wealth, these new relations. That's a kind of signal that this is a dynamic set of relations as opposed to a stagnant one. I think I should, particularly because of my new discipline, stop at 10 tip. Let me, I think, move on to, so I can at least touch on each of the criticisms. Okay, that's the fettering criticism, then it's a shift from development fettering to use fettering is the move that Cohen proposes as a way of dealing with it. A third criticism is economic reductionism. Historical materialism is a form of economic reductionism, especially in the explanation of superstructures. And this is illegitimate, that economic reductionism is an illegitimate kind of, it's bad social theory. The indictment here is typically of the base superstructure model. That's the part of the historical materialism that's being indicted with the notion of economic reductionism. The expression reductionism is almost never used as a positive attribution, although there are some people who do use it positively. So Jan Elster, who defends methodological individualism, defends micro-reductionism. That is, macro phenomena, he argues, should always be reduced to micro-interactions. That a successful theory is precisely one that explains all macro phenomena by reference only to micro phenomena. So in chemistry, you know, chemistry is successful when it explains the properties of some chemical process by reference to the elements and compounds and their microstructures and how they produce whatever it is you're doing. So reductionism in physics, in the physical sciences, is a standard procedure. That is, you do want to know what's going on. You have H2O. The expression H2O is a micro specification of this aggregate we call water. And you do want to know how H, two of them and one of O's, work together to produce the properties we call water. And to the extent that you've actually explained everything about water by virtue of the properties of hydrogen and oxygen and their interaction, you will consider that a successful explanation. Reductionism can be a positive thing. In social science, however, when anybody says that's economic reductionism, it's almost never in praise of the theory. Now, a couple of things to say about this. First of all, it's not sufficient, it shouldn't actually be treated as a sufficient criticism to say something is economically reductionist. You have to show what they fail to explain by virtue of that. You know, it's like Marxists, when I began my work in Marxism in the 1970s, the standard way that Marxism would criticize a mainstream argument would be to say it's not dialectical. And the appropriate response is, so what? You know, show me what it is that we fail to explain by virtue of not being dialectical. So otherwise it's just a kind of accusation, which may be correct, but may be irrelevant. So to say that Marxism is, that historical materialism is economically reductionist may be a correct diagnosis, but it doesn't show it's wrong. You have to also show what things are not being explained by virtue of it. And here I think there are two aspects of Cohen's argument in his defense. One has to do with the level of abstraction of his argument. He is not trying to explain everything. He's only trying to explain some things at a quite high level of abstraction. Any explanation that is offered for anything, if you shift the object of explanation, can fail. So here's just a simple example that in a debate that I was involved in. Marxists have typically explained the emergence of the welfare state and its efforts to provide to public resources some of the cost of reproduction of labor. That's a standard part of the welfare state. Have explained it by some combination of class struggles, these are demands of workers, and the contradictions of capitalism. Capitalism has a problem of reproducing its labor force, and that problem gets intensified with industrialization and urbanization, and that problem gets solved by the welfare state. So there's a kind of functionalist argument about problems of capitalist reproduction, and there's a class struggle argument about the mobilization of workers. Those two elements together explain the welfare state. Well, Theda Skocpol and Orlov argued that such explanations fail miserably to explain the sequence of the development of the welfare state, why it occurred first in Britain around 1900, second among the Anglo, you know, influenced countries. Around 1904 in Britain, 1922 in Canada, and 1933 in the United States. Why that sequence? And they argue that that sequence can only be explained with reference to highly path-dependent historical facts about each case. So in the United States had the world's largest pension system of any capitalist country at the end of the 19th century because of Civil War pensions. Civil War pensions were notoriously corrupt. They led to a vast expansion of patronage and clientelistic practices and discredited this capacity of the federal government to engage in any kind of welfare provision. So essentially, the massive quality of the Civil War pension system delayed the introduction of Social Security by a generation, is the argument. I think it's a good argument, probably. No, I have no reason to dispute it. And my response to that was this, that if you want to explain the fine-grained timing of the introduction of the welfare state, you do have to explain, you have to introduce all sorts of contingent features. But if you want to ask the following question, why did no capitalist state have a welfare state in 1830, and every economically developed capitalist state had one by 1960? So let's take a 130-year period. We want to explain why there was none in the early capitalism and why it's universal later. For that, the contradictions of capitalism and its conditions of reproduction and the role of class demands becomes the explanation. And that's a much higher level of abstraction discussion. It's not a fine-grained discussion. So part of the economic reductionism issue, I think, hinges on that. The more fine-grained is the object of explanation, the more contingent facts about the context have to be brought to bear on the explanation. Jerry Cohen gives an example. If you want to explain why the articles of the Church of England Creed have 39 articles rather than 35 articles, and why it's printed in a purple book, historical materialism will have nothing to say about it. And historical materialism does not provide explanations for why that occurs. That undoubtedly has to do with the contingent historical facts of the production of the creed from whatever the raw materials and historical and symbolic context was. And that a purely culturalist explanation for some of those details would be the right explanation. But if you want to explain why the Church of England adopted a Protestant type theology in contrast to the Catholic theology, then a reference to the role of the Church of England in the development of capitalism in England could be appropriate. He gives this wonderful, Cohen has this wonderful discussion, which will be of interest to any sociologist, of Weber's Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. I don't know if that was in part of the section of the readings that I assigned or not. You all know the standard argument. This is used as a refutation of Marxism, namely that the theological details of Calvinism explain capitalism because it created a motivation on the part of proto-capitalists to save and invest rather than consume, to accumulate capital rather than to consume. It provided all the motivational underpinnings for capitalism, the spirit of capitalism, without which capitalism wouldn't have taken off. And it provided those motivational underpinnings because of fear. That is, Calvinism said you're damned or saved by the arbitrary will of God, and the only way you can know whether you're saved is if you are successful in the world. That's proof that God's grace is on you. And so saving and investing and accumulating and being this, having this austere lifestyle, but very successful by working hard and being disciplined, all of those motivational things are byproducts of Calvinist theology. And that's the reverse argument from standard Marxism. Well, Cohen says there's research on the details of Calvin's sermons in which, if you look at how that theology developed over time, what you see is that Calvin was speaking to a bunch of proto-capitalists. And he tried all sorts of different arguments. You know, that there was a kind of, he was listening to his audience. He was saying some things, and some things really resonated and other things didn't, and that the strict Calvinist doctrine of predestination emerged endogenously from the sermons, and the ones that stuck were the ones that were functional for the development of capitalism. So you can do a functionalist reading, because the functionalist argument, after all, does require that Calvinism really matters. If it is part of the ideological superstructure, it is so because it helps to consolidate the economic base. So the fact that it has those effects doesn't show that the Marxist framework is wrong. It would only show it's wrong if it was the primary driver of the development of capitalism, as opposed to a functionalist adaptation to the needs of capitalism. And the fact that these proto-bourgeois Genevan citizens listening to Calvin responded enthusiastically to those elements of the theology and not to others, and the sermons developed accordingly, Cohen takes as the kind of fine-grained evidence of how the functional relation actually gets set in place that you would expect of a properly working functional explanation. So here's just to finish off criticism three, and then we'll continue next time. Cohen's response to the economic reductionist argument is to say, is to do this shift from inclusive to restrictive historical materialism. There's an essay in the book that's in the appendix that was published after the original book in which he lays out this distinction. Historical materialism does not claim that the economic explains all non-economic relations. It's not an inclusive claim of economic explanations of everything non-economic. All that historical materialism claims is that the economic structure explains those economic phenomena which are essential for the reproduction of the economy. So the economy doesn't explain everything about the state. It doesn't explain the state's policies towards music, except insofar as its policies towards music are important for the reproduction of capitalism. So if the economy would explain copyright law around music and trademark violation, but it doesn't explain whether, you know, jazz or classical music is at the center of the state's arts programs. Because that's unlikely to be an important an aspect of the state which plays a specific role in respect to the reproduction of the economic struggle. If it did, then it would have to explain it. So that's what restricted historical materialism says. The economic explains the superstructure, but the superstructure is not the equivalent of all non-economic relations. It's only those aspects of non-economic relations which are themselves necessary for the reproduction of capitalism. All right, we'll finish up these criticisms and do the special theory of capitalist history on Monday.
Did he say where Cohen makes that argument about Weber and the spirit of capitalism?
He said that it was in the book, but that he wasn't sure if it was over the...